And a warm welcome to Afternoons with me. I'm Bill Arnold. I am awfully glad that we're going to be together for a couple hours this afternoon. I am excited about what's going on in today's show. My friend Patrick Albanese is going to be joining me in just a little bit. And then Larry Fowler is going to be on the show, and Cal Beisner, and then Rob Barrett's going to be joining me, and we're going to have a great, great time together. I'm in 2 Thessalonians chapter 3. It says, "Now may the Lord of peace himself give you peace at all times and in every way. The Lord be with all of you." We'll take a short break and then bring on Patrick Albanese.
I'm Faith Radio Manager Neil Stavem with a word of encouragement to those of you who support this ministry and a word of challenge to those who have yet to financially invest. The encouraging news is that God continues to bring more and more people to Faith Radio, listening on air, now with 17 AM and FM signals, listening on the app, online, or on demand through podcasts. Thousands are hearing the gospel, finding hope, learning God's word, and how to live it out every day. It means transformation and life change on a daily basis. And it's because of your support that we can provide this ministry. So thanks to those of you who give. And now a challenge to you who listen and enjoy but haven't gotten around to support. Would you make a gift today of any size? Your partnership means a stronger ministry in the days ahead. And now as we count down to the end of our financial year, June 30th, we really need everyone doing something to help us meet our budget need and finish strong. Make a gift today online at myfaithradio.com.
What would you do with a brain if you had one?
Do? Why, if I had a brain,
I could while away the hours, conferring with the flowers, consulting with the rain.
All right, you know, I love Mondays, and today is no exception. There's usually 4 a month, and today is always a great day, and it's nice to be back at work, and I always look forward to talking to my friend and colleague from prestigious West Des Moines, Patrick Albanese. Patrick, welcome to the show.
Thank you, and welcome to you.
Thank you so much.
I never welcome you to the show.
That's true.
That's about time I do that.
It's about time. You know, there are a lot of people that do weekend warrior stuff, like they try to get all their exercise piled in on the weekend. I think that we are, you know, that's not what we do. We kind of spread it out over the whole week. But I did find a very fascinating story of a woman named Julianne Hurricane Hawkins. She's 103 years old, and she broke records at the National Senior Games. When she was 100 years old, she stopped biking and started running. She knew she'd be a good runner because she has a lot of practice sprinting to pick up phone calls to her landline. What about her don't you like?
Oh, I love everything about her. But it's and I think that at if I make it to age 100, that's when I will pick up running. Because not yet. In fact, I'm going to wait till 90 to pick up the biking. But I mean, what could possibly go wrong with her knees at this point, right?
Yeah. So,
oh, what the heck?
Yeah. She doesn't run regularly. She bends and stretches every day and walks around her property, watering her plants. And you know, she's lived in the same house since her and her husband built it after World War II. And you just think to,
Does it have plumbing? She's 103. That's where the sprinting comes from. Gotta go.
Yeah. Well, she was married for 70 years, and Murray, her husband, passed away when he was 95. And she just gets up and goes out and does stuff every day, and she was biking until age 100 and then started jogging and running, and now she's 103, and she's winning competitions. I just have to do a little shout out. That's just a great story.
It's a great story, but and this is to not take anything away from her accomplishment. But when you're 103 and you show up on the running track, is there anybody to your left or right? You win. You don't even have to run. You win.
Yeah, that's part of it, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, that's just a question. Because there are people that live to 103, but there's not a whole lot of them on the track.
Yeah, it's pretty impressive. Pretty impressive.
Yeah, really impressive.
So your family is all good, and over the weekend, I think you did a little bit of television watching because of the terrible rain that Des Moines got last weekend.
Yeah, now my son, who will be 9 in August, so, you're always looking for those things that you can do together, and who doesn't like a good superhero thingy, right?
Love it.
And, we've burned through some of the movies, and they've gotten all so complicated, so thanks to Netflix, we've got this you know, choice of shows. And we tried watching Supergirl for a little bit. That didn't work out too well. And then we found The Flash, which is a guy gets struck by lightning and then he develops super speed. Who couldn't it happen to?
Yeah.
That's what happened to Hurricane, whatever her name was.
Hurricane Hawkins.
Yeah. So we got through the first couple of seasons. You know, season one was really, really well done, had some nice surprises. But then I realized, you know, that one of the problems when you have a show that every week you have to come up with a new problem for a superhero is it's a superhero. You know, when you're dealing with Superman, if you don't have any kryptonite, you're kind of out of luck.
It's the one thing that works with Superman.
That's about it. It's like, well, what are you going to do? You know, the bullets bounce off him. You got any kryptonite? No.
No.
No. No kryptonite. Yeah. See, that comes from another planet. And that's pretty far away. And unless it made it to Earth, I think there's just that one hunk. And I think Lex Luthor has it. So, the second season of The Flash got, you know, a little convoluted and they had to create more and more supervillains and people had unbelievable. This guy could just turn himself into, you know, a toxic fog and kill people. And how do you defeat that? And so we finally make it to season four and we're in the middle, right, like about a third of the way through episode eight. And all of a sudden the next episode we put on, because it's got cliffhangers after every episode. Next one says, I forget the name of it, Chaos on Earth X. Part three. I can't find right. Parts two. Part three. It's part three. So I have to do an internet search. I go, where do I find parts one and two? I can't start with part three. This is in the middle of a season. What's going on here? Oh, well, part one, you have to go to the Supergirl series to watch part one. Part two is on the Arrow, a show about a guy with a crossbow who fights crime. And I guess they've somehow or another squeezed eight seasons out of that. I guess because he's probably fallible because he's human.
Yeah.
He's more Batman-ish, you know.
Right.
But they squeezed eight seasons out of that. So then you had to get to – so you had to go part two there. Then part three was The Flash, and then there was another – so in other words, they were cross-promoting all their other superhero shows that you had to go over to those and watch. That would be like in the middle of a Gilligan episode that's saying, if you want to find out what happens, tune into the Brady Bunch next week.
Right, you know? Right.
You know, and after that, the Duke's a Hazard.
Yes, yes. And so, the answer comes at the next Hogan's Heroes episode.
And then finally, I'm going to wrap it up on Hogan's Heroes.
Yeah.
And I'm going, can these guys all coexist and commingle? I don't even, you know, how are you going to get the Bradys to the deserted island? I'm not sure how this is going to work.
Yeah.
Well, they found a way to do that. And so now we're being introduced to these other shows. And he didn't bite on any of them. But we get to the middle of this one episode. And now reminding you that this is a superhero show, and it's kind of for adults and kids, you know, something for you to watch with your kids.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, in the middle of this Supergirl episode, they start having this party, and Supergirl's sister, without powers, by the way, she's just human, no powers. So take that, think about that, starts doing shots of alcohol with another woman. They get falling off their bar stools drunk.
Oh.
And then they start making out. My 8-year-old is saying, what's
this all about?
And then they show a bedroom scene with the two of them having a same sex entanglement. I go, where's the superhero stuff?
No, you're losing me now. This is bad.
And I thought, oh my gosh, what, you know, not only did you try to get us to cross over to watch all these other shows, you did it to push an agenda.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just have laser shoot out of somebody's eyes. You got to have somebody in the middle of good. I mean, I think of the old Superman, the first Superman movie that we saw with Christopher Reeve, George Reeves, but Christopher Reeves. And you know, he says, I'm fighting for truth, justice in the American way. And they kind of chuckle at him. And now I go, well, now they're really laughing at him because, you know, it's like nothing wholesome, nothing, anything.
Right.
We can't even just have a superhero fighting a bad guy anymore. It's like, nope, we've got to get this in there. And then they went on offshoots. They talked about it ad nauseum various times. She'd say, oh, I can't believe I did that. I don't do those kind of things. It's like, oh my gosh, superheroes, please. Somebody jump off the building.
That's very disturbing. The whole thing that you've just said is quite disturbing to me because superheroes are a great slice of kid life. And you love superheroes. Now they're starting to push an agenda and they're calling it normal. And this is stuff that kids are seeing. And if parents aren't monitoring this, it's bad.
I would have never known if we weren't watching these shows together. And there is no pretext that lets you know that even something like this is coming. There's nothing in the description of the show that says, by the way.
Oh, boy.
So, and it's out of the blue. It happens so suddenly that you go, where's the remote? Oh, it's, and there we are. We're in a bedroom. How did that happen?
Yeah, that's disturbing. I'm glad you brought it to my attention and to our listeners, but it is not, it's not a discussion that I'm pleased to have with you, unfortunately.
No, I mean, my son handled it well. He handles most things well. You know, he sort of dismissed it. He goes, is this one of those girl power things? You know, it's kind of his, because he sees that agenda all the time. Yeah, when we go to movies, he's like, oh, is this going to be another one where the boys are stupid and the girls are smart? Because I don't want to see another one of the boys are stupid, girls are smart movies.
Yeah. Well, he's a smart kid.
He's a smart kid. I don't know where he gets it. I don't know where he gets it.
So I tried to avoid news over the weekend, but I always try to catch up with you on Mondays about things I heard. And now I was going through some of the stories. And it's interesting that the Democratic debates are coming up and everyone's jockeying for a position. And I think they're set as to who gets what night. But I do find it interesting because I think Senator Sanders is trying to get as far to the left as possible so he has his own lane. And this whole idea of having universities
free,
I go, wait a minute, these are nonprofit institutions that are charging and supplying students with degrees that cost too much to get and don't seem to be strong enough to enable the student to go out and then reduce the debt in a reasonable time through strong employment.
Great point. And I would also like to ask, it's like you want to make universities free. Does that mean all of them? I mean, have you spoken with the folks at Harvard and Yale yet?
Right, right.
Because just out of curiosity, if it's free, even in my advanced years and inability to learn anything really, I'd be tempted to take another swipe at that.
Oh, yeah. There's no doubt.
And I'd like to be able to pick the college.
So, yeah.
Well, can I choose Harvard? Or is there going to be a selection process that says, well, yes or no? Because obviously there would have to be a selection process because everybody would choose to go to Harvard or Yale instead of their local freebie university. So how is that going to work? And is Harvard going to sign up for, let me get this straight. We can't charge these kids?
Oh, boy. Okay, I got to continue this discussion with you after the break. Patrick Albanese is my guest. We'll take a little break and we'll be right back. Welcome back to the show. Patrick Albanese is my guest on our Skype line, and we were just chatting about the whole idea of college being free. And I was thinking, Patrick, what do you say to the student that just finished sacrificing for years paying off their debt? Do you offer them some like huge tax break for the next 10 years? I mean, where do you draw the line?
Well, you would have to say, sorry, it's, you missed the Groupon. Groupon deal just hadn't kicked in yet. And I'd also be curious, you know, if you're going to really try to make this work, do you get to say to the kids, well, here's the areas that we'll pay for, because what we need are, we need some doctors and we need some, we don't need any more, let's say African-American studies teachers. If your major is in African-American studies and the only avenue of employment afterwards would be to be a teacher of African-American studies, we're full. So we'll pay for it if you get an engineering degree. I mean, will the government step in, or does anything go? Can you pick any major? And they say, we got you covered, because that's ridiculous. Even if you could feasibly find a way to pay for free college for everybody, does that mean that anything goes? Can anybody get a degree in absolutely anything? And the government says, don't worry about it. We're paying for it. You got it. We got it. You want to, I think I told you the story once. My wife worked at Cornell for just a year, and she was managing a performance, a dance show. And I went to visit her, and in the back of the room, the kids had all their books. And then there in the top pile of books, there was one called Chicano Feminist Lesbian Studies. And I chuckled. I thought it was a comic book or something like that. And
is that it was her major?
Yeah. At Cornell.
Oh, wow.
Which, Okay, 50 grand a year for that? So if you can study that if you want, if that's your area of interest, knock yourself out. But why should every taxpayer be, you know, foot the bill for that?
Mm-hmm.
Is it going, we don't need anybody for that. We don't, that doesn't have a future employment possibility. And so if you're really going to try and make this free college thing work, then I think you have to say, you got to get a degree in something we need. Why else would we pay for it?
What about free training to learn some skill? I mean, right now, you know, you've always said in the past, you know, there's big money in dirty hands. People that want to do hard, dirty work usually do pretty well in life.
Yeah. My Roto-Rooter guy, he's never idle.
Well, it's true. I mean, what about learning a trade? Will the government pay for that?
You would think that somebody could make a pretty strong case for it. Well, it's like if you're going to pay for, you know, somebody to get a degree in philosophy, and my brother-in-law has a degree in philosophy, and he got one of the coveted jobs teaching philosophy. So it kind of went the natural course of things. But if you're going to pay for that, knowing that there are limited numbers of those jobs, then wouldn't you pay for the thing we say, well, this guy will be gainfully employed? I'll give an example. As you know, I recently went to banjo camp, which has nothing to do with anything.
I know, but thanks for bringing that up again.
Yeah, the guy that I drove up with, that I carpooled with, was a high school teacher, and then he taught at the community college here. And he said the number one thing, I got to be friends with a lot of people at the collegiate level, because the number one program there is the welding program. And the teacher's complaints are, I can't get enough students fast enough. I have welding companies knocking on my door. Any students ready? Any students? I need welders. I need welders. And this guy goes around the campus trying to recruit kids saying, hey, you'll probably start at $40 an hour if that interests you. You could do the barista thing or you could weld.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got more work than you can shake a stick at. Or shake an arc welder at, I guess.
Yeah. Make sure you wear that mask.
Yeah. So that program sits there with empty seats. Honestly, I was tempted. I think I'd like to learn how to weld. That sounds fun. And can't get enough students fast enough. So why wouldn't you think, if the government's going to pay for philosophy teachers, why not pay for welders?
I couldn't agree more.
Pay a kid to go to welding school and he will have a job immediately upon graduation.
Yeah. And a good job. I remember
a really good job.
Yeah. I mean, I had a landscaping business that they wanted to offer to put some mulch down for me at like $85 a yard. And they also said if you wanted any weeding done before the mulching, it was $60 an hour to weed. Remember when a highly trained technician didn't make $60 an hour?
Well, I was a highly trained weeder.
What were you making?
$2 a bag.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
It was, you know, my grandparents lived two blocks away from us. They were a tremendous source of money. You always had to exchange work for it. And so usually it was knock, 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 you know, grandma and grandpa, hey, come on, get some stewed prunes. That was the offer, you know. After
Come on in, get some prunes.
I got a bowl of stewed prunes here for you.
That's
not the thing you introduce an eight-year-old to. But, yeah, Grandpa was well known for handing you a big old black plastic lawn bag and saying, fill this, $2.
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah, now, you know, you had to be specific because if you didn't say weeds, I'd put everything in there. It's full.
Yeah.
Pretty fun.
So
but,
I'm not...
$60 an hour to weed. I hope you get more than one guy weeding.
No, I don't think you do. I think it's one person. That seems outrageous, of course.
You know what? I would stake out every place there was a weed and say, if that thing comes back, you're going to have me to deal with. $60 an hour, I expect that weed to tell the other weeds to just leave.
Right. So, you know, I'm not a huge fan of all the tweeting President Trump does and can be a little obnoxious at times. But I know recently he put out a tweet saying that he was going to do some illegal alien deporting. And, of course, that just sent everyone into... a catastrophe mode, which says, what, are you going to deport 11 million people? And he was thinking, no, I'm just going to deport those who are illegal aliens, criminal elements hiding in sanctuary cities. Yeah. And if he does that, you know, the Democrats really can't say, well, that's a bad idea.
Well, so here's an amazing thing. A poll came out recently, and don't they always come out recently? But issues that are important to people, illegal immigration and the border kind of tipped the scales at nearly 25% of what people were most interested in. If you added up things like free college or health care or gun control, those added together did not eclipse how important this illegal immigration issue is to people. Now, you got to figure what side are people on, because it's not like they're saying, you know, anybody reasonable, you'd say, well, we can't have it be unlimited, correct? Because if they say yes to that, you say, well, that's not going to work. Mm-hmm. So if it isn't unlimited, where do we draw the line? How do we draw the line? That's all. Otherwise, because there's either unlimited or limited. And when there's limits, we need to know where we draw the line. Is it a number of people? Is it qualifications? What is it? And somebody's going to have to, at the Democrat debate, spell this out. What are your limitations? Because if there aren't any, the American people kind of need to know, because that's a choice. Do you want to just open it up and say anybody that wants to come here gets to come here? Because I don't think that flies.
Yeah. So another thing that happened over the weekend, the Willendas, two of them, brother, sister, 25 stories high, New York City, Times Square. That's pretty nerve-wracking.
Yeah. Yeah. What is it about the Willendas?
I don't know, but they keep doing these near-death stunts, and I don't get it.
Well, sometimes, you know, they kind of surpass the near-death part of the experience.
Well, that was the dad, I think, yeah. But they're believers that they look for opportunities to share their faith all the time. So I always go, way to go.
Yeah, well, I'm a big fan of that, but that's, you know, I always say God has a flair for the dramatic. This is certainly a way to get people's attention, although I don't think I want them convincing other people that, you know, believe in God and you can walk across a tightrope 25 stories up in the air.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, Patrick, we just have about 45 seconds left. I guess you'll be glad to know 7-Eleven is starting their Slurpee delivery. There you go.
Okay, that's fantastic. Can I pay with a $2 bill?
You probably can. You have one, don't you?
I had this philosophy, I had this theory that if I gave my kids allowance money in $2 bills, the $2 bill is so unique and cool that they wouldn't spend it, they would save it.
I like
it. And it was a fantastic idea. So I got a giant stack of these things, and then for allowance, I'd be like, I will give them $2 bills. Now, you're probably wondering how well it worked out. I've yet to give a $2 bill. Because I don't want to give them up. I love these.
So you're keeping it for yourself, what you're saying.
My wall, I'm going, they get 10 this week because I'm not giving them up my twos.
Okay.
Twos.
All right, Patrick, always good to catch up. Thank you so much for coming on the show. As always on Mondays, we always look forward to it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, all right, we'll take a short break and we'll be back with lots more in just a minute.
On Faith Radio.
Welcome back to the show. I'm awfully glad whenever I get a chance to speak to Dr. Cal Beisner. He's founder and national spokesman of the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation. It's a network of over 60 Christian theologians and scientists and economists and other scholars that are educating for biblical earth stewardship, economic development for the poor, and the proclamation and defense of the good news of salvation by God's grace received through Jesus. And every time you listen to Dr. Beisner, your IQ goes up about 17 and a half points. So I'm always excited for that. Cal, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Bill.
Nice to have you on again.
I'm not sure that I can guarantee the 17-point increase, but give it a try.
I'm personally guaranteeing it. All right, I want to throw this out because I read this yesterday, and I thought that's something I got to run by Cal. And I'm going to summarize this article into about three sentences, but here it is. The Arctic Ocean is warming up. Icebergs are growing scarcer, and in some places, the seals are finding the water too hot. Reports from fishermen, seal hunters, and explorers all point to a radical change in climate conditions and unheard-of temperatures in the Arctic zone. Within a few years, it is predicted that due to the ice melt, the sea will rise and make most coastal cities uninhabitable. And that article came out in 1922.
Yeah, I was just thinking as you read that, that sounds familiar to me. That sounds awfully much like one that came out around about that time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, it's the same tune that we're being told in recent years about the Arctic. And the fact is that that does happen. And the reverse happens as well. It goes pretty much cyclically. The cycles are driven primarily by changes in solar energy output, you know, from the sun itself, and in cycles in ocean currents, especially the Pacific Decadal Oscillation and the El Nino Sudden Oscillation, El Nino La Nina. And what we tend to see is that the Arctic loses ice in a period that lags behind El Nino by, anywhere from about 5 to 9 years, and then it gains ice as we get past that period. So we had significant ice loss in the period following the major 1998 El Nino that made 1998 the warmest year on record for the satellite data, which is the best we have. And again, we're likely to see some loss following the very warm 2015-16 El Nino. But we have recovery in between such things.
So when you look at this report from 1922, did they say this was settled science back then? And do you have any idea what you think the global response was to this report?
You know,
I know it's speculating.
I think that, you do have to get me speculating here a little bit, don't you? I don't know what was the global response to that. I don't think that at that period, scientists were as prone to claiming settled science as many of them have become in more recent decades. And I think that's because of the politicization of science. Science tended to be far less politicized at that period. In recent generations, though, we've seen pretty much all of life politicized, and I think that's a very sad thing. And it has really injured science itself. Because, frankly, science has never been about consensus. As soon as people start talking consensus, you know that they're not really talking science. Consensus is political value. You find out who won a vote, who won an election by counting votes. A consensus is not a scientific value. Science, rests on empirical observation. You have to get those facts, those data. And those often contradict consensus. And in fact, major scientific consensus has been overturned many times in the past and will be in the future.
Cal, are how scientists getting compensated, has that changed over the years?
Yeah, that's a very important point, too. As a matter of fact, it's a point that President Dwight David Eisenhower made in a speech, his farewell address to the American people back in 1960. He famously warned about what people began to call the military-industrial complex. He warned of the danger of having more and more of our industry dedicated to defense production and how that would politicize the economy. But he also warned, and people didn't really pay so much attention to this, against what he called the takeover of science, and especially of basic research, by government funding. He said that the result of that would be that politics would begin to dominate what kind of science got done and what sorts of conclusions were reached. And I think that's exactly what we're seeing in the whole global warming alarmist movement.
How many scientists, what percentage of scientists are able to do their research because of a government grant?
That depends in part on the particular field of science that you have in mind, but the National Science Foundation and various different government agencies are hugely important sources of funding for scientific research all over the world, not just in America, but other countries as well, and especially in climate science. Over the last 30 years or so, government funding has come to totally dominate, and because our government has largely been largely supported the notion that a changing climate is a reason for government policies that shift more and more control out of private individuals' hands and into the government's hands, that has meant that, frankly, if you affirm dangerous man-made global warming, you're likely to get funded. If you question it, if you deny it, you're likely not to get funded. That's just the way it's gone.
Yeah, that's not good news for scientists. It's not good news for science. Scientists are, you know, they're glad they're getting their projects funded, but they can't really offer too much conflicting evidence to whatever agenda they're being funded for.
Right. Yeah, and you know, the whole aim of this, really, I think a lot of it is to shift control of our lives into the hands of the government. And a part of what's being used to justify that is the claim that free enterprise capitalism is really bad for the environment. That's why I wrote a booklet called "Is Capitalism Bad for the Environment?" And in the first part of that booklet, I compare the environmental records of more socialist and communist countries with those of more free market and capitalist countries. And frankly, it's not even a close competition. The worst environmental disasters in all history have occurred in the more socialist, big government, centrally planned economies. And then the second part of the book, I really refute the five most common and, I think, serious arguments of those who think that capitalism harms the environment. One of the ideas is that capitalism is indifferent to nature. A second is that capitalism assumes unending growth. And the third is that because of that, capitalism leads to resource depletion. Fourth is that capitalism imposes unjust costs on others. And the fifth is that capitalism prefers the immediate to the long term, and so it doesn't bring about a sustainable way of life. And in fact, I find that each one of those is false, and that capitalism actually does far better on every one of those measures than does a centrally planned economy. The Cornwall Alliance is publishing this booklet, and to the end of this month, we will send a free copy as our way of saying thanks to anyone who makes the donation at our online site and asks for it.
Yeah, I always take advantage of your offers, and I've received a lot of materials after donations, and they're really a donation of any size, isn't it, Cal?
Absolutely, any size, literally.
Yeah, and that's cornwallalliance.org?
Yes, cornwallalliance.org. They'll just click on the donate button and fill out the form and mention in there. There's a comment spot. Mention, please give me your booklet, Is Capitalism Bad for the Environment? I'm glad to send it.
Now, I just don't know why people think that we need to abandon free markets to protect the environment. I mean, to me, that seems kind of nuts. And you probably do a nice job of explaining that in this booklet. So I do want you to tease a little bit more.
Here's a bit of a tease for you, Bill.
Okay.
Why do you find graffiti on public bathroom walls and not your bathroom wall at home? if you know the answer to that, and it's a pretty obvious answer, you know why capitalism is better for the environment than socialism.
Yeah, that's so true.
It's not all that complicated.
And I can't remember who gave this definition, but somebody said capitalism is the suppression of freedom, or socialism is, I can't remember.
Socialism is the suppression
of freedom, and who wants less freedom? Why would we want less freedom?
Yeah. Well, you know, some people want less freedom because, frankly, they want more security. You know, Benjamin Franklin said, whoever would give up a little liberty for a little safety deserves neither liberty nor safety. But I think people have always had a tendency to say, look, I just want to be made safe. I want to be secure. And if I have to give up some of my liberty for that, fine. I think, frankly, that George W. Bush, when he said that the universal yearning is for freedom, for liberty, unfortunately, I think he didn't really understand human nature terribly well. And it's sad because the actual historical record is that where people are the most free is also where they thrive the best.
Oh, of course.
Spiritually, politically, personally, socially, in every way, freedom serves human thriving, and government domination does the opposite.
Yeah. Now, Cal, you're way more up on this than I am. Do you know what the young kids are being taught in schools right now relative to the environment?
Oh, my goodness. All across the grade levels, from kindergarten right straight through college, climate alarmism, the idea that human emissions of CO2 and other greenhouse gases are causing dangerous global warming that we must fight, even if it costs us trillions and trillions of dollars, that dominates across our public schools and even in most private schools. It dominates in the colleges. It's pretty well everywhere, and it really needs to be challenged. Students need to challenge it, and they can get a lot of really good information to help with that challenge just by going to cornwallalliance.org, reading some of the articles that we have there. We have hundreds of articles and a number of major studies, and we think that would serve them well.
Yeah. My guest is Dr. Cal Beisner, and if you are thinking you'd like to ask him a specific question, let me know via text, 877-933-2484. Again, that number is 877-933-2484. We'll take 90 seconds and be back with Dr. Beisner in just a minute.
I see trees of green.
Welcome back to the show. I've got Dr. Cal Beisner on our guest line. He's the founder of the Cornwall Alliance. Head over to cornwallalliance.org because that is a website loaded with great articles and great information. And Cal, you know, I was thinking about social justice, and maybe you would be so kind to talk about the difference and how it contrasts with what the Bible means by justice. I know our listeners would love that.
Boy, I'm so glad you asked that question. For nearly 30 years now, over 30 years now, the meaning of justice in the Bible has been a major, major focus of a lot of my study. I've written a couple of chapters on it in one of my books back in 1988. I've written a booklet on it called Social Justice versus Biblical Justice, How Good Intentions Undermine Justice and Gospel. And I've lectured on the subject at many different colleges and universities. So this is an issue that is very dear to my heart, and it's especially dear to my heart because when, by embracing the notion of social justice, we get confused about what the Bible itself means by justice, we wind up being confused about the very meaning of the gospel itself. The gospel tells us that our justification before God, our being declared righteous in His sight and forgiven for our sins, is not a matter of justice to us. It's not what we are due at all. It is a matter of grace. It is a benefit bestowed upon us, despite the fact that we deserve exactly the opposite. But in thinking about social justice and the claims of social justice proponents, justice really begins to be the idea that everyone is due benefits regardless of what they deserve, what they have earned. And that confuses justice and grace. The social justice movement basically is a movement toward what we would call egalitarianism in the economy. Everyone ought to have equal or at least less unequal incomes. Everyone ought to have equal or at least less unequal wealth. And it really doesn't matter what people do. But biblically, the term justice is defined as rendering impartially and proportionally to everyone his due in accordance with the righteous standard that is God's moral law. And so the criteria of justice are impartiality. All the rules have to apply to everybody without any favoritism whatsoever. And proportionality, that is, what is done to people has to be in due proportion to what they themselves have done. So, for instance, we don't execute shoplifters, but we don't just punish murderers with a slap on the wrist, right? And then also justice needs to look at what people have actually done, what they deserve. And grace is very different. Grace says we want to give benefits despite contrary deserts, despite the fact that somebody deserves something opposite. And God has ordained the state to enforce justice. We read of that in Romans 13, where it says that God has set up the powers that exist to be his servants. The Greek word is actually deacons, to be his servants to execute vengeance on those who do evil and to commend, to praise those who do good. But he's ordained the church as the vehicle for grace to preach the gospel. And when we confuse those two, we will inevitably obscure the meaning of the gospel. And that's sad because it's the gospel. It is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes.
Oh, that's fantastic. I so appreciate that perspective. And we talk about, you know, we hear about CO2, and I mean, that always comes up in conversation. And there's rising atmospheric CO2. Are there some benefits to that, though?
Oh, yeah, there are. Real quickly before I address that, though, let me mention, I did do this booklet, Social Justice versus Biblical Justice, and though we offered that as our thank you gift for donations a couple of months ago, frankly, if anyone would make a donation of any size to the Cornwall Alliance now and ask for Social Justice versus Biblical Justice, we'll go ahead and extend that offer.
That's awesome. I got that booklet, by the way, just so you know, and it's incredible.
Great.
It's really, really good.
Oh, thank you.
Yes.
Thank you. Glad you enjoyed it. Well, as to CO2 in the atmosphere, yes, there certainly are benefits to CO2 in the atmosphere. One of them is that if there were no CO2 in the atmosphere, there wouldn't be any life on the planet.
Of course.
That's kind of a big one. Plants need CO2 for photosynthesis, and we need photosynthesis because without it, there's no oxygen in the atmosphere. So we breathe in oxygen and breathe out CO2, we and all other animals, and plants take in CO2 and put out oxygen. So there's this wonderful symbiotic relationship that goes there. The really important thing is that with more CO2 in the atmosphere, plants grow better. For every doubling of CO2 concentration in the atmosphere, you get an average 35% increase in plant growth efficiency. They grow better in wetter and drier soils and in warmer and colder temperatures. They make better use of soil nutrients. They resist diseases and pests better. And so they expand their ranges. Deserts begin to green. Plants move, can grow closer to the poles or higher altitudes where it used to be too cold for them. But besides that, they also improve their fruit-to-fiber ratio. And the result is more food for everything that eats plants and everything that eats something else that does eat plants. And that's great for all of life on Earth, especially for the world's poor, for whom affordable food is absolutely crucial. So as a matter of fact, one major study a few years ago of the impact of the added CO2 that we've put into the atmosphere since 1960 concluded that it's added all by itself, $3.5 trillion worth of crop yields from 1960 to 2012, and that we can expect it to add another $9.6 trillion worth of crop yields between 2012 and 2050. Hmm. That's all really good stuff.
That is good. Now, Cal, recently I was reading about the drought in India, and there's 330 million people affected by that and soaring heat temperatures. When you talk about global climate change and all of that, how do stories like this factor in?
Well, you know, a drought is weather. Climate is what happens over a period generally thought to be 30 years or longer. And just exactly where you draw that boundary differs from scientist to scientist. But no climate scientist, no meteorologist would say that what happens over a period of 6 months, 2 years, 4 years is climate. That's weather.
Okay.
And
I'm glad to know that.
That just happens cyclically.
Okay.
That's not an indication of human-induced dangerous global warming. It's just an indication that weather happens.
But it is disturbing, and when you see stories like this and you see these soaring temperatures, but India is pretty used to soaring temperatures, aren't they?
Oh yeah.
They just didn't get the they didn't get the monsoon rains though this year, which is what they need.
Yeah, right, which occasionally happens. And actually, by the way, they got some of those monsoon rains a little earlier than usual. We have a fellow who writes often for the Cornwall Alliance, Vijay Jayaraj. He is a climate scientist himself, and he lives in India. And he wrote about that about a month and a half ago for the Cornwall Alliance blog, that some of the monsoon rains came to India earlier than usual. And when that happens, very frequently what happens is that shortly after that, you'll have less rain than usual for that particular period of the year. So I think what we're seeing is cyclical. It just happens, and it has really nothing to do with long-term trends in global average temperature.
So, Cal, when we hear things like computer climate models, do we trust those? Do we trust those, or do we have to raise an eyebrow?
Well, I think we can trust and verify. That's what Reagan said about what we should do with the Russians on arms control. And I think it makes good sense about everything scientific and about an awful lot of things in life. Paul tells us in 1 Thessalonians 5:21, test all things, hold fast what is good. But climate models, like any other models, are helpful. They're useful. They help us to understand systems better, natural systems better. But they really can do that for us only if we are willing to carefully test those models by comparing their output with real-world observations. And then when the real-world observations disagree with what the model predictions are, we need to be willing to revise those models because, frankly, the models are simply hypotheses. You and I learned long, long ago in grade school that science works basically by you get a guess, you get a hypothesis about how something in nature works, and then on the basis of that, you predict what you should see if you run experiments in the laboratory or if you go out into the real world and watch things, and then you compare what you actually see with what your guesses were.
Mm-hmm.
And if your observations contradict your predictions, your guess was wrong, and you have to change it. You have to revise it. Unfortunately, over the last roughly 40 years, most of the climate scientists working in this field have not seemed to be willing to apply that basic scientific principle. And so the climate models continue to predict that we ought to be getting about 0.3 degrees Celsius of global warming every decade, whereas in fact, from 1979, the beginning of the satellite data period, which is the best data we have, to the present, the actual warming rate has been about 0.13 degrees Celsius per decade, just slightly over a third of what's predicted. And we don't know that all of that came from CO2, although the models say all of it should have come from CO2.
Yeah.
Furthermore, there has been no statistically significant global warming in the last roughly 20 years. And that's totally contrary to the models. So what we need to do is to check and verify.
Yeah. Well, it makes my head spin, Cal, but my IQ is way up just from talking to you, so thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Bill. Yep. The Lord bless you.
Lord bless you, too. I want to point all the listeners to the cornwallalliance.org, cornwallalliance.org. We'll take a short break and be right back.